Tata Purusha Medena.
Tata Purusha Medena.
Harishchandro Mahayasa.
Harishchandro Mahayasa.
Muktodara Jajadevam.
Muktodara Jajadevam.
Varanadin Mahatkata.
Varanadin Mahatkata.
So there's no purport, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more verses to finish the chapter, and all have no purports. Say something then. What shall we say? Bhagavatam is a book from another time. That is quite clear. It is not, although the knowledge of Bhagavatam is timeless and eternal because it gives the knowledge of devotional service. Sometimes it also describes things in a historical context of other yugas and other eras and so on. So sometimes the Bhagavatam surprises us. We see here a reference to Harishchandra, who sacrificed a man, which looks kind of, well, what shall we say, extraordinary. Thereafter, the famous King Harishchandra, one of the exalted persons in history, performed grand sacrifices by sacrificing a man and pleased all the demigods. In this way, his dropsy created by Varuna was cured. All that we can think about is that such personalities were not the same as the people of this age. In this age, animal sacrifice is forbidden. It says, asvamedham dhavanambam, that both asvamedhiyakyas, or means horse sacrifices or cow sacrifices, are forbidden in the age of Kali. Now here in Bhagavatam there's an indication that previously even men were offered in sacrifice. That's extraordinary. We have heard about how Brahmanas were reviving animals that were offered in sacrifice, and how these animals were again getting restored in a better body, in a youthful body. They were being brought back to life by the Brahmanas, who were in this way testing the power of mantras. There's even a Puranic reference about a Brahmani, the wife of a Brahmana, who at that time was pregnant. And it is said that when ladies are expecting a child, they get some intense craving for a particular type of food and so on. And according to the Vedic injunction, it is mentioned that if she doesn't give in to this, that then she'll have a child which will always dribble from the mouth. And subsequently, so the cow was being sacrificed. And then the lady got a desire to taste some of the flesh, and she took some of the flesh of the cow. But then the Brahmana revived that cow by mantra. And then suddenly that piece of flesh in her hand also came back to life. At the same time, the Brahmana, to his surprise, noticed that there was a piece of the cow missing. Anyway, she took that and she threw it on the ground. And that became onions and garlic. And it says also carrots. What shall we say? Some Puranic histories. So, the history of the universe is not just a mechanistic history. Not just that a hot substance, a hot gaseous substance, sometimes known as nebula, cooled down and eventually became a planet, and so on and so on. And that one day the sun will also, like that, cool down and become a moon, and like so many other planets. A mechanistic idea. Now we see that the universe comes about in a very personal way. And we see that in the beginning of the creation, in other yugas, there are personalities with very great powers. So it's astonishing that sacrifice of a man is mentioned here, and at the same time that the performer of the sacrifice is described to be a famous person, Mahayasa, a very famous person, described as one of the exalted persons in history who performed grand sacrifices and sacrificed a man. We can only understand that this man became elevated through that sacrifice, greatly elevated. Otherwise, how could Harishchandra be famous for such a sacrifice? Not to be imitated at another time by personalities who have not been graced with the same power and so on. So that's how these things should be seen. These are also not the details of the Bhagavatam that we may immediately present to the guests at the Sunday feast or something like that. Yeah. You know, in the Bhagavatam, even men sacrifice. Of course, in the 10th canto, there are also references of Bhaumasura, who had captured 20,000 kings that he was intending to offer to Mahabhairava. So what can be said about that? That is a ghastly form of Lord Shiva. Such kind of worship is not at all recommended. That is the kind of worship performed by the Shaktas. You see, the Vedic culture has different levels of worship. And the lowest level of worship is the Shakta. The Shakta are those who are trying to pacify the ghastly material energy by making offerings. The idea you see in the Old Testament, you see a description of how there was a prediction that in every family a son would die, and then, but wherever they put the blood of a lamb on the doorpost, the angel of death passed by. And things like that are Shakta. That is a Shakta idea, that somewhere up there is a bloodthirsty ruler, and we must pacify him. And if we don't want him to take our blood, then we must give him other blood. And therefore, we sacrifice goats, we sacrifice chickens, we sacrifice buffaloes, we sacrifice all kinds of creatures, and even sometimes human beings, with the idea to pacify those deities out there, so that everything, their thirst for blood will be finished, and then all of us can live very peacefully. So this idea is the idea of the Shakta. That's why we see Durga worship like this, pacifying material nature. Kali worship. Kali is the same Durga, but in her angry feature, in her aggressive feature, when material energy is at its most bloodthirsty feature. So therefore we see the goddess Kali is being worshipped with so many offerings of animals. So this is considered the lowest level of God consciousness. One level higher are the Suryas, or the worshippers of the sun. Because the Suryas, they are worshipping the life-giving force within the universe. Of course, we can see Egyptians, we can see the Incas in the history of the world, but amongst this Surya worship is also prana energy. Right? So that puts Reiki right in there with the Suryas, right? For example. Or other types of prana, healing the chi. Chinese movies, people flying to the other side of the room and so on, or even cooking on chi, I've seen in the Chinese movies. On the plane you get a good sampling of movies. You see this guy like baking an egg, just with shakti from his hands. Saves gas. That's about it. Otherwise, what is the value of such kind of shakti and powers and so on? There's a story about a man who practiced for so many years to get mystic power, and finally he learned to walk on water. And he went back to his village and he told all the people, "Yes, I have this power, I can walk on water." Oh, everyone was excited. Oh, you must show us. "Tomorrow I will show." Everyone assembled along the river, and then the yogi walked across the water. He did it. And everyone was really excited. "This is amazing." And one old man said, "Well, I don't think it's worth very much. I don't think it's worth more than 5 paisa. So the yogi was very upset. "Oh, you are envious of me. You are criticizing me. You're saying that my mystic power is not worth more than 5 paisa. He said, "Yes, it's not worth more than 5 paisa. You walk across the water, and I take the boat for 5 paisa. So it's not worth more than 5 paisa. So all these material mystic powers are really not worth that much. I remember that there were books about Carlos Castaneda, and Carlos Castaneda had taken peyote, like some mushroom or something, and he was under the training of a real Indian medicine man who taught him all kinds of tricks, who taught him how to run in the forest at night, who taught him how to find energy points in a waterfall and in this way walk across, climb across the waterfall. Well, it was interesting. I bought book number 2. I bought it all the way up to book number 4. And in book number 4, the hero, who is the warrior, he's a warrior, he finally meets death. Right? And then when he meets death, there is a final dance with death, and by his mystic tricks he manages to stop death for a moment, and then finally he's defeated by death. Then I thought, this is all rubbish. You know, I took the book and threw it in the bin. And what is the point? What is the point of all this great mystic power if anyway we lose it at the time of death? So the Suryas are trying to harness power within the universe. So their worship is the worship of great energy and power. The next level up of God consciousness are those who are approaching him with a business mentality. Oh Lord, won't you buy me? And fill in the blanks. Yes. Or in the Vedic culture, in Ganapati worship. Oh, Ganapati is so nice. He looks so cute. And he gives all these benedictions because Ganapati takes away the obstacles on the path. So this is a narrow-minded type of spirituality. Really looking at the material situation and using spirituality to benefit the material situation. But it's still better than the other two. Because there is a concept of connecting, of making offerings to a personal deity and getting benedictions from the personal deities. But it is a very small type of worship. Greater than that are the Shaivites, or the impersonalists. The Shaivites are connected to impersonalism because we see that in the Brahma Samhita, Lord Shiva is described as the creative force. It's interesting how Shambhu is described as the creative principle, because we thought Lord Shiva was the destroyer. But now he's described as the creative principle. How is that? Well, in the Brahma Samhita, we find that it is described that Lord Mahavishnu glances upon pradana, which is the potential of the material world, that then the glance becomes sadashiva. Sadashiva enters into that pradana, which then becomes activated. So in this way, Shiva becomes the generating principle. And therefore we see that in the Vedic worship we get that form of the lingam, which is a combination of a male genital and the female genital, representing Shambhu, the generating principle, and Prakriti, the female receiving energy. So in this way, the lingam is representing the material energy coming into being. And then, of course, the universe also dissolves and enters back into the body of Mahavishnu. So the impersonalists are taking this aspect of seeing the generating principle, awakening Prakriti, and then again these manifestations become wound up. And they see that behind all of that is actually Brahman. Therefore they take to the worship of Shiva, in his form of the lingam. So there's so much impersonalism everywhere. In Islam, there is also impersonalism everywhere. Although Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave a personal explanation of the Quran. Unfortunately, we don't have that explanation in its full form. But we hear that he gave a personal explanation of the Quran. Otherwise, generally speaking, impersonalism. It is said that historians say that actually impersonalism came into Islam via India. It is said that the Sufis came to India and became influenced with the Mayavad philosophy and then brought it back to the Middle East and established an impersonal understanding of the Quran, which now became predominant. So the point is, impersonalism exists in all kinds of cultures. Also in the Western world, there's ample of impersonalism. Here in Germany, there was Meister Eckhart. I forgot the date, but Meister Eckhart was at one point developing a whole theology, how we are actually God, right? How he was God and everyone is God, and he was excommunicated from the church at one point. You know more about that, Peter?
No.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. No, Preetu is the expert on Christianity. I'm just, I don't know anything. Anyway, so Meister Eckhart. And then We also see very interesting that in the late 50s in America, the beatniks came up. They were the forerunners of the hippies. And the beatniks, they were beginning to look into expanding consciousness. So they were into experimenting with drugs and so on. And they started to read books that were about expanding consciousness. And one of the big books that the hippies were reading was a book written by Aldous Huxley called The Doors of Perception. And if you hadn't read that book, you were square, right? Totally square. And it was about Aldous Huxley in 1945 took LSD, and he wrote a book about it. And he even took it as he was dying, as he was leaving his body, he took it again. And then he also died on LSD. It's like an interesting way to go. Anyway, so Aldous Huxley became a big hippie prophet, and he was a complete impersonalist. St. John of the Cross, right, in the 15th century, is also describing how actually he's realizing that he's God. So there is impersonalism. So in the Western world, there's a lot of impersonal history, and the hippie movement started out with impersonalism. Jack Kerouac wrote a book on the road about, he was another hippie prophet who wrote a book about the Dharma bums, who were sort of living on the road, and it was all Buddhism, it was all Sunyavad. So when Prabhupada came in 1965 and started to preach against Nirvishesh and Sunyavadi, delivering the Western countries from impersonalism, then it was a fact. It was right there in the Western world. So it's not just something from India, something like Kirtananda thought. Kirtananda said to Prabhupada, why are you just so much stressing impersonalism, Mayavad, here in the West? Why? In India, you have so many Mayavadis. But why not here in the West just preach against atheism? And Prabhupada said, you're saying that because you are a Mayavadi. You are an impersonalist. And we see that the West is full of impersonalism. We also see that in Christianity, initially there was a concept of a personal God. That somewhere up there in the sky there were heavens, and there was the heaven and whatever was there, shepherds and sheep and angels and all kinds of celestial beings. But then the brothers Wright invented the plane, and they went up above the sky, above the clouds, and they saw nothing there. And by now everybody has been up there. And I don't know if you saw any angels. I mean, I've got quite a few air miles behind me, but I never saw any angels, Gandharvas, or nothing up there. Absolutely nothing. Sorry about that. So, in the face, under the pressure of modern science, Christianity had to really retreat. There was Bishop, what was his name again? Is that? No, not Urquhart. That bishop who calculated that 5,000 years ago, Adam and Eve were driven out of paradise. I think I'm mixing up names. Professor Urquhart was Prabhupada's professor, and it's almost the same. Anyway, this well-known Christian scholar, who was very, very prominent, calculated on the basis of like a systematic calculation of going through the ages of all the great personalities in the Old Testament, and then tracing back the whole lineage. Right? He made a calculation and came to that Adam and Eve were driven out of paradise about 5,000 years ago. And this is still, this stood as being accepted in the Western world up to like the 18th century, when Indologists were going to India to preach the gospel and to kind of establish that India was like a primitive country, and when they came up with the ideas of the Aryan invasion, that real culture came to India from outside. Still, at that time, in the intellectual world, this idea that Adam and Eve were driven out of paradise 5,000 years ago had not yet been eradicated. Thank you. Yeah. So that was is amazing, right? If you look at that, then you see that like the modern astronomers, they think that the universe is about 10 billion years old, and the Vedic literature says about 5.5 billion years old. Okay, that's at least both in the billions, right? That's kind of close, you know, 5.5 billion, 10 billion, but 5,000 years old? I mean, where were they, right? Where were they? So in the face of modern science, Christianity had to withdraw and had to give up many of its ideas. So what happened was Christianity dug in the second position. It left in an army, there are trenches. It used to be like that. There used to be trenches. So there's the trench in the front, and the army is dug in the trench. They try to hold the trench. Then when the opposing army gets too strong, they have to withdraw. They have to withdraw. Then they would have a second trench where they could, again, go in the ground and hide. And so they would withdraw from the first one and just, okay, go down to the second position. So in this way, Christianity went for the second position of impersonalism and saying, actually, God is an all-pervading all-pervading love, an all-pervading intelligence, and an all-pervading love, and this whole idea of, you know, the angels in the clouds and all that is simply anthropomorphism, where the human reality is projected upon the spiritual one. A lot has been written about anthropomorphism, and even Einstein got into it, who also was a first-class Mayavadi. And Einstein also gave a very enlightened idea how God consciousness in its primitive form is trying to appease the ghastly deities, and that then in a higher form God consciousness becomes moral, but still man is projecting a human feature on the absolute reality. And then, in its enlightened state, God consciousness has become formless and just the all-pervading. Anyway, and, you know, after that, we need not hear much more. We know where we are. We know we have reached Mayavad philosophy. So we can see how much Mayavad has actually penetrated in the Western world. For example, we can also see how Christianity got rid of the elves and all the other romantic entities and so on who were there in previous beliefs and who were being respected and worshipped. There are 33 principal demigods, and then each of them are assisted by 1 million smaller demigods, and some even elves are little demigods who are protecting. So there are such protective spirits and so on. I remember a very famous community in Scotland, Findor, Brito also knows. Yes, so Findhorn was extraordinary because Scotland is quite on the northern side. And, you know, it gets quite cold, huh? Because Scotland is high. It is the plains, the high plains, and it's north. And therefore, in Scotland, what grows in Scotland is not what grows in ordinary places. A bit less. You know, the seasons are short, and many plants don't grow. Yeah. But Findhorn. In Findhorn, people started again to pray to the elves and to the spirits that protect the plants and so on. And to everyone's amazement, it worked. They started to grow flowers out of season. Fruits were growing in abundance where nowhere else in Scotland fruits were growing. Findhorn became famous like that. It was like a community. Pumpkins, almost as big as Cinderella's coach. Yeah. In short, it was absolutely a miracle. And it became very famous. Lots of people were going there and so on. Anyway, so, but Christianity, it got rid of all that of all these personal elements. All these personal elements in the universe. So we see how it became a vehicle of impersonalism, actually. And how impersonalism in this way gradually has taken over. And how now we again systematically have to begin to think in a personal way, which is difficult. Which brings us then to the topmost level of God consciousness, which is Vaishnavism or personalism. And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur states that even Christianity in its original form is also there in this personalist category. And in that way we can see that also there is a history of personalism. There is a scholar, a devotee named Jan Olof Bengtsson, who wrote a book which is called The History of, I forgot the exact title, but the topic is The History of Personalism in the Western World. And he traces out like exactly where personalism was existing. It's a useful book, a little academic, but useful. He's a devotee. Yeah, so it was there, this personalism also, everywhere in the world. But now it is our business to very thoroughly appreciate it like that. And therefore, we are appreciating all the great saintly personalities that have existed in the past, that have been the demigods, the great empowered sons of Brahma, or other great personalities who existed in previous yugas. Because it is by these personalities that auspiciousness has been created. You remember, you know, sometimes you get these kind of stories that that some Buddhist stupa is broken somewhere in the Himalayan mountains, right? And suddenly all this disaster starts to happen in the world. You know, have you ever heard such stories? I have. Of course, we don't believe in so much in the benefit of Buddhist stupas, but definitely we believe in the benefit of devotional service on the planet. What if there would be no devotees on the planet? Then what would it be like right now? The influence of the devotees, right, is felt, is greater than we think. Sometimes we wonder, what happened to all those books? Up to, I forgot the number, but it's more than 500 million books that have been distributed. Up to this moment, all over the world. So, and how many devotees do we have? And I wonder, like, no, many people have read these books. Many. And we saw there was this, there was some advertisement some years ago of Microsoft. Yeah? And we all had this little clip, you know, which showed a child taking birth in a hospital. And the child was shooting out of the womb, right? Originally shooting out of the womb and then flying out of the window and flying in the sky and growing. And then as he's flying to the sky, there's a whole changing body's diorama going on, like from a baby to a grown up to an old man, and then at the end he landed in the grave. Crash. Have you not seen? Yeah, it's really good. I lost it somehow or other. You know how computers are. You get these things and they go, but I used to have it. It's gone. Yeah, it was clearly inspired by Prabhupada's books. There's no doubt about it. And one day, you know, I walked into a room somewhere and there was a Bhagavad Gita of Sai Baba. Right? So, okay, I had a look at it. And there were whole passages that were copied from Prabhupada's Gita. Plagiarism, really. I mean, exactly the same, you know. But the only difference was that whenever Krishna was saying, you know, surrender unto me, then Sai Baba said, yes, surrender unto me, you know. I am that, for the rest. I could see that Sai Baba had also read Prabhupada's books, without a doubt. So there's a lot of people who've read the books and have used them for their own purposes, naturally. They did it to Krishna. They did it to Prabhupada also. In Bombay, there was a dentist who wrote a commentary to the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna was a dentist and Arjuna was a patient. I mean, what is this? What do you call this? I call it business. That's all it is. The Gita has been used, Krishna's Gita, Krishna's words have been used for people's personal profit, and Prabhupada's words are also everywhere in society and used for people's personal profit. But meanwhile, they act and they penetrate invisibly into all nooks and corners of society. We can push it forward consciously and in many ways. But first, we ourselves have to overcome the contamination of impersonalism, the contamination of being Shaktas, the contamination of being Suryas, the contamination of being Ganapachas, the contamination of being impersonalists, and become pure devotees of the Lord. Okay, thank you very much. I know it was a long thing, but it's a whole chart, and once you start it, you're locked in. You can't get out. Finished it now. Any questions or comments?
There's as far as man sacrifices, there's an interesting story. There's this island of Iona in Scotland, which is very famous. It's a early Christian settlement from the 4th century. And even nowadays, many people go there. It's become a kind of New Age place because it's the earliest kind of Christian spirituality known. Now, if they built a church, they performed the man sacrifice. The saints, the monks, believed that one person should sacrifice himself to protect the church. And so one person came forward and they asked, is there anybody here? And one person said, yes, I sacrifice. And his name is Odran, Saint Odran. He became a saint. And they dig them into the ground, into the foundations of churches, and it's a church. So then, 200 years later, they enlarged the church. And when they were digging the foundation, they heard knocking. Someone was knocking. They opened up, Saint Odran came out. 200 years later. And they said, my God, and he said, I'm Odran, you know, I was victim here 200 years ago. He said, well, what are you doing all the time? He said, well, I went to heaven. But I also saw hell. So they asked him, the monks asked him, it's all in the history of Iona. they asked him, well, how was it? What's your realization? He said, my realization is that neither the heaven nor the hells are eternal. They're temporary. They're temporary manifestations. So when they heard it, the monks covered their ears and said, oh, this is the upper art. It's against church doctrine. He is a heretic. And they digged him in again. And he's still there. That's a famous story. Saint Audra is in Yuna. But he was accurate, you know. He went there and he said, I saw with my own eyes, heaven is not eternal and heaven is not eternal. It's temporary. But he had some realization.
Yeah, anyway, intense.
There's this impersonal worship and personal worship. Where does the universal form fit in?
The universal form? Well, in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada says that in order to begin to get a concept of personalism, the impersonalist can start meditating on the universal form so that he can start seeing personality behind everything within the universe, behind all the functions of the universe. Yeah. So you can get out of this mechanistic, impersonal idea of the universe. It's just...
Is it actually formed?
No, it says it's an imaginary form. Universal form is an imaginary form, it says.
But what did Arjuna see?
Not that same form. He saw a universal form of Krishna. It says the universal form of Krishna is temporary. Yeah. He saw a particular universal form. Yeah. But it's not Krishna's eternal form. Sometimes described as imaginary, sometimes described as temporary. Duryodhana also once saw a universal form, but not as elaborate as is Arjuna. It's like that. And Arjuna saw the universal form in relation to the destruction. You know, he saw the battle of Kurukshetra, and he saw how that related to the universal form, and he saw all the heroes being chewed up and so on. Whereas he didn't see how, in the second canto, it's described how when the universal form developed, you know, the sun and the moon as eyes, then the sense of sight was there. See, with the description, he saw another aspect of the universe.
Please. Isn't it that even today the born-again Christians are teaching that the earth was created 5,000 years ago?
Is it, Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Well, it's CC. Yeah. This. I'll look up today the name of the I'm mixing it up. Gosh. It's not Urquhart. Is it? That was the name of the professor probably in Scottish Church College. Professor Urquhart. Yeah. It's something very close to that.
The sages were testing mantras on these sacrifices.
They were chanting?
Testing
mantras, yeah.
My daughter, she asked me what happened when they did something wrong. What happened to those?
Then there was one brahmana who was very expert. So there was, in the yajna, there were many priests, not one. And there was the main priest was sitting on the side, and he was just observing the whole sacrifice. And when any one of the priests made one mistake, it was very strict. If they even chanted one syllable wrong, the whole meaning of the mantra of the yajna changed, and he got a different result. So this one brahmana was just watching to see that everything went right. And if there was a mistake, then he chanted mantras to counteract the mistakes. So that's how they safeguard it. You tell your daughter.
you mentioned about worshipping Ganesha, Ganapati, for removing obstacles, sometimes people say that, well, we are also worshipping the Shingadev for removing obstacles. Of course, there's a big difference between the Shingadev and Ganapati, but why not just worship Krishna? What's the issue?
Well, the Shingadev is Krishna. And it's like very clear that he is Krishna, and in the seventh canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it's mentioned that Prahlad is a devotee of Krishna, particularly. Krishna is mentioned, so that's interesting that he was worshipping Krishna, not Vishnu. It says he was a devotee of Krishna, and but Nrisingadev is especially he is the soft feature of Krishna. See, he's very soft. Because the outside is a little hard, like nails, like thunderbolts and vajranaka and like and all these kind of things. But the Srimadev came out of the pillar, out of his soft-heartedness. Yeah? Just like we would also get quite angry if someone tries to kill a child right in front of us, I would possibly also turn into something into violence. Right? Whereas usually I'm not into violence. So Srimadev is actually a very kind and merciful feature of the Lord, yeah? Who appeared out of his soft-heartedness for his devotees. So like that, we look at Lord Srimadev as an especially merciful form of Krishna. And therefore we approach him. He's especially merciful. Especially kind, especially protecting against demoniac influences. Even, and then we see that, like in Mayapur, in Navadvipa, we have, of course, Nrisingapali described in Navadvipa Dhammahatmya, but there's a second book which is called the Navadvipa Bhava Taranga. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur goes again to all the holy places in the Dhamma, the same places he described in Navadvipa Dhammahatmya. But the only difference is, this, in the Navadvipa Mahatmya, he's describing what the place is. You know, this happened there, and this is the nature of the place. In the Navadvipa Taranga, he's describing what's happening to him in terms of his own personal experience and realization when he is in those places. And when he comes to the Nrisingapali, he's praying. He's explaining how he is being. How he's praying to become relieved from all the material contamination so that he can become an eligible candidate for the worship of Radha and Krishna. So in this way, our worship of Lord Srimadev is in that mood of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Vigna Vinasam, to become, that he may take away the obstacles in our hearts so that we become eligible candidates for the worship of Radha and Krishna, which is, of course, the principal worship of our Sampradaya. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Radha Krishna Mahayana, Lord Chaitanya, is none other than Radha and Krishna. Because you see, this Nrisingadev is none other than Nrisinga Chaitanya. You may call him Prahlad Nrisinga, he's manifesting as Prahlad Nrisinga, but he's Prahlad Nrisinga Chaitanya. Actually, there is that mood of Lord Chaitanya within the worship of Lord Nrisingadev within our sampradaya. In our sampradaya, we're worshipping Nrisinga Chaitanya. Sometimes I'm seeing some of these prayers that come from South India. I see little books with Nrisinga prayers, and then some of them are really intense, you know, like about destroy my energy, my enemies, kill, 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 right? Such prayers, you know, kill my energy. That's not really, we don't want to kill any enemies, right? We just want to kill the demoniac mentality. Yeah? So some of these prayers are not suitable for the Nrisinga Chaitanya mood, which is a different approach to Lord Nrisinga than some of the South Indian moods. Peter.
Yeah, the Prahlad Maharaj's prayer, you know, Om Namo Bhagavate Nrisingaya, that prayer, the Prabhupada says in the purport that we should pray this prayer. And in the prayer it says, Kamasayan Randayarandayatamo. Please, my Lord, destroy Kamasayan, my demon-like desires, Randayarandayatamo, throw them away, and my tamo, my ignorance.
Yeah, you know, yeah, that's the Vigna Vinasa.
It's a very important prayer. You should actually learn that prayer. Because it's the most important prayer, Prabhupada said to Lord Nrisimha. It asks for two things, that please destroy my demon-like desires, and the other one, give me abhayam tamo, make me free from anxiety. Abhayam. Grasa. You know, make me free from anxiety. These are the two things we have. We have anxiety and we have demon-like desires. Because we have demon-like desires, therefore we have anxiety. So in this prayer, Om Namo Bhagavate Narasimhaya, Namaste Jastejasi, Abhi Bhagavad Vajraka Vajra Damsra Karma Shaham. There it is. Randaya Randaya Tamo. Destroy, chase them away my ignorance. So that's a prayer right there in the fifth canto.
Can learn it now to you.
Grasa, grasa.
Fifth canto. Yeah. Fifth canto, 18:518.
This one?
Oh, no more, yeah.
That one is
518 something.
No, I just
867.
Okay. It's in the fifth canto.
Yeah, Rukmini can do it. She's good at that. Rukmini, find it, please, so the preacher doesn't have to go to his phone.
It's here.
Yes.
In one book I have read, it was about Narasimha Dev in Mayapur, that the deity, the second deity which is coming, takes the mood from the first deity, from the main deity in the temple. Mm-hmm. Is it like that?
I don't know. That may be, you know, like there may be such a reference somewhere. There's so much information out there. I don't know.
Because I was thinking the first one was Radha Krishna gave, so.
Yeah, but you see, like, it is. There may be some reference like that, but there is a bigger concept. And the bigger concept that it is the Chaitanya Yuga, right? This Yuga is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Yuga. So everything now is touched by that special grace of Lord Chaitanya, the whole Yuga, everything. So therefore, as soon as devotees, right, begin to worship in any other form of Krishna, they all get that Chaitanya element. They all get that mercy of Lord Chaitanya. Even, it doesn't matter, even Radha and Krishna now get more merciful than in other yuga. Every deity gets sort of swept up in that mood of the yuga. That's the yuga dharma. So all the deities have a tinge of the yuga dharma. That's the bigger complex. We end. Si, si, palapa, singa, chitanya, chitanya.